News You're Don Bradman, a podcast from SBS. In each episode, we'll have a look at champions, athletes, idolized by millions, that you might not know about. The kind of champion or hero next door. Welcome to Who's Your Don Bradman. Welcome to Who's Your Don Bradman. Every episode, I'm joined with Dario Castaldo from SBS Italian. How are you, Dario?
Bonjour, Christophe. Very, very well. I feel like a student who's done his assignment. I'm nice. I'm ready. I'm prepared.
You're ready? Let's check it out. Your notes then, if you are a student. Today, it's about tennis. It's a passion of mine, but it's not even a passion of yours. It's even higher than a passion for you.
It's my life.
Dario lives and breathes tennis all the time, 365 days a year. Guillermo Vilas. Why does he qualify as a Who's Your Don Bradman pickup for this episode 2?
Because in approximately 50 years of so-called open era, we've had 27 male tennis players who reached at some stage the world number one spot of the ranking. We've had Pat Rafter, who's been there just 1 week. We've had Novak Djokovic, who's been there over 360 weeks, which means 7 years. And of course, there's a debate on who's the greatest ever, the GOAT of tennis. But there's not a single debate on who's been the best player who's never been ranked world number one, because it was definitely Guillermo Vilas.
Let's take a break and listen to the history of Guillermo Vilas. Guillermo Vilas was born on August 17, 1952, in Buenos Aires, in Argentina. He is a poet, an author, and also probably the best Argentinian tennis player ever. Professional from 1970 to 1992, he won 62 men's single titles on the ATP circuit, including 4 Grand Slams and a Masters. A tennis icon of the 70s. He won the French Open and the US Open in 1977, the Australian Open in 1978 and 79, and the year-end Masters in 1974. First Argentine player in history to conquer a Grand Slam tournament, he also reached 5 other finals in major tournaments. In Australia in 1977, at the French Open in 75, 78 and 82, at the World Championship tennis final in 76. He also has 16th main double title to his name, mainly won with Romanian player Ion Ciriac. With the Argentinian team, he won the World Cup in 1980 and played the Davis Cup final in 1981 in the USA. Guillermo Vilas completed 9 consecutive seasons in the top 10, from 1974 to 1981. He reached his highest official ranking in 1975 at second place in the world. And this is where there is a controversy, and we'll touch a lot more on this podcast today. He was a versatile player with 3 major titles won on grass. The Argentinian has also set historic records on clay, making him one of the greatest specialists in the surface. Considered one of the finest players of his era, Vilas was inducted into the International Tennis Hall of Fame in 1981. And to understand what Guillermo Vilas means for Argentinian players, we spoke to the best of him, the current number one Argentinian player, Diego Schwartzman. He talks to us about the legacy of Guillermo Vilas.
I'm not very young now, but you know, when I start to play, he already, you know, retired. But Guillermo, I think, represent the world tennis in our country. When everything start, Guillermo and Batata Clerc both were playing. Guillermo before, he was one of the best in our sport history. So for sure, I think not me, but the before generation of players start and become tennis players because of him, and I think everyone loves him in our country. Yeah,
someone you want to emulate in the career?
I'm, you know, late to do it. You have to start winning titles when you are 15, maybe, to, you know, follow his steps. But I think everyone remember his name every time. And for our history and our tennis in Argentina, he was and he is very important.
This was the story of the Maradona of tennis, Guillermo Vilas. So that was a short history of Guillermo Vilas.
Guillermo.
Well, let's face it out. He spelled Guillermo Vilas, but because he's Argentinian, and Argentina has got a specific take on Spanish, let's say, and then I'm happy to stand corrected, but it's Guillermo.
Guillermo. Okay. That's the accent for the Argentines.
Absolutely.
Shuvia.
Let's talk about the personality of the man himself. Tennis was at a different space at the time, and he was someone a little bit special in a special era of tennis.
Yeah, Guillermo Vilas was born in the early mid-50s, like Jimmy Connors, like Vidas Gerulaitis, like Bjorn Borg. Ilya Anastase was a bit older. John McEnroe instead was a bit younger. But anyway, he was part of this generation of players who were possibly the first, inverted commas, citizens of the world. Those guys were literally part of the flower power generation. They grew up inspired by Woodstock. They were beautiful guys with long hair.
So what do we know about him? What do we know about who he is? Because he's still alive. Guillermo Vilas is still alive. As a tennis player, as an athlete, what was his personality? Who was he?
He was, of course, very talented, both as a tennis player and even as a writer. He published a lot of books and novels, not just in Argentina, but even in France. He had a strong and complex personality. The flip side is that he had a bit of an edgy character on and off the court. This was confirmed to me by Eduardo Pupo, the famous Argentinian journalist who became very, very close friend with Vilas, who wrote his official biography, but also became the co-author of the Netflix documentary dedicated to Guillermo's life. When I asked him to describe Vilas as a person, he compared Guillermo to a rock star.
Guillermo Vilas fue, sin duda, es un rock star, ¿no?
Guillermo Vilas was, he is, without a doubt, a rock star, along with Björk, Girolautis, McEnroe, Connors, even Adriano Panatta. They were people with a much bigger mental load than we are used to seeing.
Vilas evidentemente fue arrogante también.
Vilas was obviously arrogant too. He recognized that. He had a very big ego. But without that ego, he would never have been number one in the world.
Nunca hubiese sido el número uno del mundo.
So really, I mean, we know that in tennis, the attitude is everything as well. We saw it actually just only a few months ago with Daniil Medvedev in the final of the Australian Open in 2022. But Guillermo Vilas, how would you describe that attitude? Was it arrogance? Was it, you know, sure of his self-belief, you know, or is it somewhere in between?
You know what? Comparatively, nowadays, tennis legends are a lot more politically correct. They are, or they pretend to be a lot more humble than back in the days, back in the 70s. Some say that this humbleness is one of the key of the success and longevity, and I'm talking about Nadal, Federer, etc. But tennis, in terms of sport, is as technical and as physical as it is mental. So you can basically win matches just by outsmarting your opponent or because you're mentally tougher and full of self-confidence. So there's a fine line between being self-confident and being assertive, between being charismatic and being arrogant. Obviously, Vilas was a tough guy with a big ego, but also with an amazing work ethic, as we also were told by Maximiliano Bozzo, an Argentinian journalist, who's now the head of the communication of the ATP tournament in Barcelona.
On court, he was courageous. He played fiercely. He never gave up. And off court, I have to say, despite he's one of our heroes, he was a difficult person. And I think he wasn't an easy person. And sometimes these kind of things happen with people that have to carry the weight of being amazingly famous. He was difficult.
So, off court, Vilas was a man of his times, opinionated, disdainful, etc. Whereas on court, both in terms of style and attitude, it was more like a Rafa Nadal 1.0. I know this is blasphemous, but the only parallel that makes sense is with Rafa. No one can really compare to Nadal technically and in terms of results. But Vilas was also a lefty, just like Rod Laver, like Jimmy Connors, like John McEnroe, of course. But like Nadal, he was someone who would leverage on his fitness and his grinding, diehard attitude and spirit using heavy topspin, at least for what was possible with the rackets over time. But for a more technically accurate description of Guillermo Vilas, let's hear what two former players told us, starting with American Brian Gottfried.
Obviously, he was very steady, very solid. There was a different style of game that was starting to develop. There were a couple players, I think, that really kind of led the way with this new heavy topspin style of play: Borg, Lendl, and Vilas. And I say it that way because a lot of the rest of us played more attacking tennis, and then all of a sudden, we're seeing guys play with heavy topspin. They're keeping the ball up higher, up by your shoulders, up above your shoulders, in fact, which was a very difficult ball to play. And it was also, they could be offensive, playing closer to the lines with high margin of error because of the topspin. The ball would travel higher over the net, so higher margin of error.
It's fair to say that Guillermo Vilas was a pioneer, someone who changed the game. Unless you were ready to die on court, it was going to beat you. This is what an Italian former tennis player told us, Claudio Pistolesi.
It changed a lot, the game, bringing the spin. You start to find another way to go to the top. Before it was very technical, so much about to go to the net. And it showed another way, you know, together with Bjorn Borg, playing 40, 50 rallies. You want to work the point every time, makes you tired, and to send the message that unless you do very difficult game on variety, he was going to win the match because he simply played one ball more than you. There was practically no balls that he could reach. So yeah, I think he was the pioneer of another way of go to the top in tennis.
So very interesting take on the personality of the man that Guillermo Vilas is and was as a tennis player. Just take a second on this. It's not a joke when we talk about the fitness at the time, because some players smoke. Some player had fried eggs and bacon and baked beans and whatever for breakfast. So that we're talking about that era. We're not talking of people that just refine nutrition to the extra little bit that would give them the extra edge. They were having bacon and egg for breakfast, yeah, and smoking in between games.
Yeah, there's a great anecdote. It's got nothing to do with all these, but former Italian number one, Adriano Panatta, played an exhibition match, or rather an exhibition tournament in Monte Carlo with Bjorn Borg and another couple of great players of the time. They both won the semifinal. The next day they were playing for the final, and there was a check of about $30,000, and we're talking about the late 70s. At the time, you could buy a big apartment with that money. Anyway, after winning their respective semifinals, both Panatta and Bjorn Borg went out partying all night the day before the final. And according to Panatta's version, the story goes that Bjorn Borg drank so many vodkas, he got completely wasted, so wasted that Panatta had to literally drag him back to his bedroom. Nevertheless, the next morning they played the final and Borg won 6-1, 6-2. And at each court exchange, Panatta was telling him off because of that. But yes, somehow at the time they were less diligent than nowadays. We would say maybe less professional.
Yeah.
They were not very strict in terms of habits. No, you wouldn't win a game like that.
I think I can imagine how many vodkas Federer is having before a match, and he's zero. And that's zero.
I don't think Novak Djokovic has ever had a bonbon or a little chocolate sweet.
If we talk about the mateship, today it's a very solitary world. The Medvedev don't really interact on a daily basis except on a court with the Djokovic or the Nadal or the Federers. They all live their own life and they build a team around them. In the 70s, in the 80s, tennis was a total different world. And Guillermo Vilas, or Guillermo Vilas, was a bit of a different sort of attitude to it as well. Someone like him right now would have been traveling business class, first class everywhere, had a whole full staff crew around him. That was not the case at the time at all.
It wasn't. You know, tennis is obviously an individual sport. Everyone, you know, looks at their own businesses. But at the time, you couldn't afford to travel with your fitness trainer, with your coach, with your mental coach, with your physios, with your manager, with your fiancé. I mean, tennis players at the time were traveling on their own. Plus, they didn't have, you know, laptops as well as
social media,
of course, mobile phone and social media. And so we asked American Brad Gottfried, who was world number three at the time, and who also happened to know Vilas since they both were 18, to describe life on tour for professional tennis players back in the day.
Yes, we were friendly. I mean, we were coming up in a time that, which was the beginning of open tennis. Open tennis started in 1968, and I first came on the tour, on the pro tour in 1972. So, you know, the prize money was just starting. We were just starting to build these great events. So you didn't have a lot of extra money to bring a lot of extra people. So you were friendly with the other players. We hung out with the other players. We would play hard during the day. We'd try to beat each other's brains in. And then we'd have dinner together at night.
And often drinking together as well.
Well, I didn't do much of that. But we would have, my point is, we would have spent a lot of time together on and off the court because we were traveling the world together. You know, we would spend hours and hours after the matches, hours and hours in the locker room talking and laughing and playing backgammon and playing cards. And that's what we did back then. You know, there weren't a lot of the extra curricular things that you could do as there are now with computers and mobile music that you could take into the locker room and wherever. You know, we had each other. We talked, we had each other, and we laughed. And then we played.
It's incredible, Dario, that you spoke to a former number three in the world, and especially someone that actually lost against Guillermo Vilas in my hometown of Paris and the French Open.
Yeah, yeah. Touching on Paris, La Ville Lumière actually meant a lot to Vilas. In terms of career highlights, he won 62 titles. Only 9 men in tennis history did better than him, including 4 Grand Slams events, 2 of which in Australia. But he was one of the best clay court specialists of all time. So the French Open was his backyard, or actually would have been his backyard if it wasn't for Björn Borg. Still, Guillermo Vilas won in Paris in 1977 when he beat in the final Brian Gottfried in straight sets. And this is what Gottfried himself told us about that match.
I certainly had my best year in 77, but we were all overshadowed by what Guillermo did with his style. It was just very difficult for me. I'm trying to attack. But the ball that Vilas hit, very high above the shoulders, it was very difficult for me to attack on that ball. So that meant a lot of unforced errors. And when I did come in, the approach shot had to be perfect because he passed well. So it was a long day, but it was a short day.
So speaking of the French Open, he played the last time at Roland Garros in 89 when he was defeated in round one by Italian player Claudio Pistolesi. You explained to me what it meant for him to share the court with a legend like Guillermo in Paris.
I remember when they tossed the draw, I saw Vilas. My knees were shaking. And even if he was at the end of his career, and I knew I have a big chance to win, but still, you have to do the job and you have to forget to play against one of the biggest legends of the history of the game, 1989, full stadium, and so many people came, and most likely everybody knew it was the last Roland Garros he was playing. And they, of course, they cheered for him, but I knew that, and I was almost myself cheering for him, but I had to beat him, you know, because I was a tennis player, and I did. I think my level at this moment was higher than him. He was 36 years old, I think, and the score was, you know, relatively easy. It was, I think, 6-2, 6-3, 6-4, something like that. But I felt emotions that in my life never go away, because on the match point, all the public was shouting his name very loud.
Vilas, Vilas, Vilas. I thought the only possible thing for me to respect Guillermo was to put my racket down on the ground and start to cheer as well with the public. Vilas, Vilas, as well.
And we couldn't play. You know, we stopped for about 5-6 minutes, standing ovation for him on match point. So the best thing I could do is put down the ground my racket and start to cheering for him too and shouting his name for many minutes. And the umpire was keep saying, let's play, let's play, let's play, but nobody care. And so we have to honor Guillermo. And then on match point, I won and we had a big hug. And all those years when I met him, he hugged me and they remembered that I told him it was an honor to play with you. And thank you for what you did for the game. I was in tears. And so this is a very, very special match of my life, of course.
So now let's talk about the controversy and one of the reasons why we're talking about Guillermo Vilas today, because there is this amazing documentary on Netflix. If you have Netflix, I would encourage you to search for Guillermo Vilas on the platform and have a look at this documentary on him, because basically he was robbed. Or was he? The question about this, was he or has he ever been number one in the world? On paper, he hasn't. But if there was an Excel spreadsheet at the time, he might as well be number one, yeah?
You're going to hate me for these.
Come on. For that as well.
For this very reason. Okay, let's try to let the numbers talk. In one of his very best season, 2013, Rafa Nadal won 10 tournaments, including 2 Grand Slams. In 2015, Novak Djokovic won 11 tournaments, including 3 major titles. In 2006, Roger Federer won 12 tournaments, including 3 Grand Slam titles. And in men's tennis history, people look up at John McEnroe's 1984 as one of the very best season ever, because he won 82 matches, only lost 3 games, and won 13 titles, 13 tournaments. Having said that, in 1977, Guillermo Vilas from Argentina won 130 matches,
yeah, okay,
only lost 15, and won 16 tournaments, 14 of which on clay, including 2 Grand Slam titles. And then he won a third major crown at the Australian Open at the beginning of the following season. So this is arguably one of the all-time greatest seasons ever for a male tennis player, except Vilas wasn't awarded with the world number one in that 1977.
That is incredible. With all this, at the end of the day, at the end of the year, when all the points were counted, he's not number one in the world. Why?
It's a bit hard to explain, but the key is probably that at the time, the ranking system was more about the average best results. So playing less tournament would pay more dividend than playing a lot of events. Even though you played an outstanding season results-wise, like Vilas in 1977, a season highlighted not just by his title at the French Open, which we already mentioned, but also by his victory at the US Open against the 1977 world number one, Jimmy Connors. A victory that, according to Brian Gottfried, maybe could not be enough to call Vilas the best player of that tennis season, but regardless, was for sure a huge achievement as well as a great surprise.
Yes, yes. Yeah, that was very surprising because Jimmy always played well against Bjorn and Willie. He liked that higher ball, didn't bother him. I think what was surprising was the way Willie's victory was accepted by an American crowd. You almost got the feeling we were playing in Argentina. I don't know that there was 100,000, but there was a lot of people, and there was and they really accepted him as the winner. And I think Connors was going through some times when he wasn't as well accepted, as well liked in the U.S. So I think some of that probably played into the crowd's acceptance of Willie's win.
So Gottfried was just basically sitting nicely outside of this number one, number two, seeing the battle happen. And that's quite interesting to see what he means. In your heart, Dario, should he have been number one or not?
Well, more so than in my heart, we can definitely say this is curious because this is exactly what Claudio Pistolesi said. So let's hear what in his heart was the answer to this question and to this controversy.
Did he ever went to the top as number one? You know, it's still open question, you know, because if by the logic, the results he made, that's what they say, you know, it was number one. If at some point you have 3 slams and 16 tournaments won, it's impossible you're not number one, but you've never been officially. So I think one of the biggest questions in the tennis world, in the men's tennis, is was Vilas number one? And many things say yes. My tendency, looking by the logic, is yes. But you know, others say that no, and the ranking was following some other kind of logic. I don't know. But in my heart, he was number one.
So, according to former junior world number one, Claudio Pistolesi, Vilas was a number one at some stage in that 1977 when he almost dominated the tour. On top of that, according to journalist Eduardo Pupo, Vilas felt like he was the true number one because he was unbeatable.
Creo que lo que hizo en 1977...
I think what he did in 1977, winning those 53 matches on a slow court, I think is one of the great milestones in world tennis, because he used to say, I couldn't lose in 1977, and that's something that's very strong.
So thus far, we got emotion. We let the emotion and the opinions make the talk. But again, let's get back to numbers, because this is what ranking is all about. And in that 1977, as we mentioned before, Guillermo Vilas won an outstanding 130 tennis matches. Particularly after Wimbledon, he won 7 consecutive tournaments, all on clay. Not just that, because he set up a 46 consecutive matches winning streak on different surfaces. But he was particularly unbeatable on clay. He set up a 53 match winning streak on that very surface, which stood unbeaten until Nadal demolished that record in 2006. Anyway, this winning series came to an end in October 1977 in a final of a tournament in France, in Aix-en-Provence, when Vilas lost to Ilie Năstase, the Romanian. And the fun story is that Vilas retired after 2 sets because Năstase was playing with a racket, which later on was considered
illegal. Double swing.
So
yeah, double swing on each side.
He needed a double amount of strings to beat Vilas.
It's one of the weirdest racket I've seen in my life,
and it's awful. It's not a beautiful one.
It's horrible. I mean, people, if you listen to this podcast, go and Google it. It's horrible. It's a horrific racket.
Yes, and the joke is you needed that racket to beat Vilas at the end of that 1977, in which Vilas won 72 of the last 73 matches played before the Master. So although he was lucky at times, for example, Bjorn Borg, who beat him 3 times on clay, he didn't take part to the French Open, and that's also one of the reasons why Vilas was finally able to win the Roland Garros. Besides, it was lucky here and there. But anyway, Vilas won everything and everywhere else, including a memorable US Open crown in the final against Jimmy Connors at Forest Hills. And yet it was Connors who was awarded the world number one. So that could have been a turning point. That could have been a defining moment. That could have been the proof that in 1977, Vilas was the best player of the world. For sure, according to Maximiliano Bozzo, that was probably the biggest achievement in Guillermo Vilas' career.
He changed a sport in a country. I think that is the most impressive achievement for Vilas. But if I have to mention a result, a tournament, I would say the US Open 1977, when he beat Jimmy Connors. I think that was his greatest achievement in terms of tournaments won, especially because his opponent was the one who he was fighting for the world number one. And in that year, that 1977, that was a special year when Vilas won almost everything he played. That victory stated his supremacy over Jimmy Connors and the world of tennis that year.
So the greatest achievement of Vilas' career in the best season, not only of the Argentinian player, but arguably of any male tennis player ever, wasn't enough to guarantee the world number one spot to Guillermo Vilas, who actually took it seriously, the matter, but only decided to raise it in relatively recent times, as we were told by another Argentinian journalist, Sebastian Fest, who's been in the business for 30 years, and told us he was one of the very first to talk about this topic and this controversy with Vilas himself in Monte Carlo.
During the talk, I ended asking Vilas whether he was really convinced that he was the number one in the 1977 season. And he looked at me with kind of a half smile, like ironic, and he said, number one, I was the one, the number two, and the number three that season. There was no one better than I. Wow, okay. So we kept talking about it, and I said, but what can you do with this? No, I will do something. I mean, the ATP and the ITF, she said, they did a mistake while calculating the ranking and they will have to change it. So I will be the number one.
So on that terms, Dario, do you think this could ever be overturned?
Well, the funny thing is that there is a connection with Australia, as in Vilas became aware that he had even the possibility of raising the issue in December 2007 when the WTA, the Women's Tennis Association, corrected the 1976 ranking and determined that Yvonne Goolagong had climbed to the top spot of the ranking. So based on this precedent, Eduardo Pupo, the journalist, began his 7 years long investigation that involved collecting all the men's tennis results from 1973 to 1978.
Just take a second here. The records were not necessarily computerized at the time, because we're thinking iPhone, this was not necessarily computerized. We're talking pencil and paper.
Absolutely. And the biggest spreadsheet you will probably ever see. This was a massive investigation, a work that required the review of 22,500 matches, 110 players, 542 tournaments, and Pupo did all this with the help of a Sydney-based Romanian mathematician, Marian Ciulpan, whose contribution was pivotal. So Eduardo Pupo told me that they didn't do all this looking for a financial compensation, not at all. All they wanted was a symbolic dollar, because this was nothing about money. It was mostly about acknowledgement of an achievement. It was obviously about pride. And it was a matter of finding the truth.
Bueno, lo único que quiere es que sea reconocida la verdad. Él no está buscando nada, incluso desde lo económico.
The only thing he wanted is for the truth to be acknowledged. He's not looking for anything, even financially. So much that we both signed a document for only $1. He as a tennis player and I as a researcher.
Bueno, él en todo momento fue el último que se enteró de mi estudio.
You can see it in the documentary when I gave him an envelope where the accounts where his number one was. He lived it with great joy and emotion. And well, we have cried together at some point because the ATP said yes three times and then say no three times, because it was no sure. And the first time, which is what you see in the documentary when the lawyer tells us that the ATP had accepted to homologate the number one, is when he starts to cry with emotion, joy and anger, as a cumulative discomfort, right? This is the summary of what he felt. A great frustration first, a great joy later, and a lot of uncertainty when the ATP began to say no, that is to say, to have doubts, whether to say no or later to say yes.
Y mucha incertidumbre cuando la ATP comenzó a decir que no, o sea, a tener dudas si decir que no o que sí.
In other words, regardless of the numbers, which according to Eduardo Pupo and his investigation should confirm without a doubt that at some stage Vilas was the world number one in tennis, the ATP, the body that organizes the tour, is reluctant, maybe understandably so, to rewrite history.
Bueno, el argumento básico de la ATP cuando negó homologar el número uno de Vilas fue que es imposible reescribir la historia.
The basic argument of the ATP when they refused to homologate Vilas number one was that it is impossible to rewrite history. That's very important. The ATP did not say that the study was wrong. Actually, they say it was an admirable study.
Ellos no dicen que esto no es verdad. Dicen que sí, que está okay, pero que no saben cómo darle el número uno después de 50 años.
They are not saying that this is not true, but they don't know how to change it after 50 years. That is something very easy. You can make a retrospective up to 1975. You did it with Ivan Goulagon. You gave the number one, and that's it, and there's no more problem.
Pasó con Ivan Goulagon y listo, y no hay ningún problema más.
That's a beautiful gesture from a beautiful idea that some people are not necessarily driven by the money, although a dollar is probably a lot of money somewhere, I don't know, but anyway. If we just go away from all those numbers, Dario, that's enough numbers, please.
Let's talk about, I got one more.
Come on, last one.
We mentioned the Excel spreadsheet.
How many rows?
It was made of 313,000 lines and 50 columns.
Yeah, okay, that's your last number, Dario. Finish. Okay. Let's talk about the impact on tennis, the impact that is left. We've heard earlier on at the opening of this podcast, Schwartzman, the number one Argentinian player right now, talking about the impact that Guillermo Vilas has on Argentinian tennis.
Well, someone told us that he's been the Diego Armando Maradona of tennis for Argentina, not because Vilas can be compared to an absolute legend of the sport like Maradona, who was the greatest of all time, but because it was able to make people proud and passionate about tennis, because he attracted the general public in Argentina to a sport that used to be limited to the upper class. So this is what Maximiliano Bozzo told me.
Before Vilas, tennis was a sport played by the upper middle class. It was called the white sport here. It was just for a few people. But when Vilas, someone who was raised in a middle class family, someone who loved to have his long hair, that was a revolution. A revolution in terms of image, a revolution in terms of what was then marketing, a revolution because he was a person that made everyone believe that tennis was for everybody. And he achieved that not only through his image, but also through his victories. So that's how Vilas made a great impact, not only in tennis, but also in the society, because he became a role model, definitely a role model. And if I could compare Vilas with another sportman in Argentina, definitely that person would be Diego Maradona. Vilas was to Argentine tennis as revolutionary and as transcendental as Maradona was for football. And of course, I'm not comparing them, but if I have to pick someone, that would be definitely Diego Maradona.
He's also considered the best South American tennis player ever, even though both Chile and Brazil had officially a world number one, respectively Marcelo Rios and Guga Quirten. But Vilas was somehow revolutionary in his impact. He changed the whole continent approach to tennis, of course, particularly in Argentina. Let's hear again journalist Sebastian Fest on this very topic.
He was a game changer not only in Argentina, but in South America and Latin America. So I had once a long conversation with Quirten talking about this topic, and he said, hey, look, Vilas was the biggest one. You can say I'm the number two in the South American historical ranking, but Vilas was the one. Tennis in Argentina changed dramatically in a big way with Vilas and after Vilas. There were so many players after him that you can say that the Haites, De La Peñas, Mancini, Pérez Roldán, Coria, Gaudio, Nalbandian, even Sabatini, they wouldn't have been possible without him.
So to conclude this podcast, Dario, he's finished his career relatively late in terms of age when you look at the champion and how hurtful the sport actually is as well. He's one of the later, the player that played until quite late, like Connors, but they don't all go all the way through to that older age.
No, absolutely. So he played his last ATP tournament in 1992 at the age of 40 years and 3 months. When I asked why, Eduardo Pupo explained not just the reason why Vilas played until he was well over 40, but also helped us to paint more of Guillermo Vilas' personality through his love for the game, through his passion, through his pride, and through his stubbornness.
Y una vez me dijo que le preguntó Pete Sampras por qué seguí jugando, y él le dijo
Once he told me that Pete Sampras asked him, "Why you're still playing tennis?" And he told him, "Because I love tennis. There is no other reason. I want to die playing tennis." When I did this interview in Monaco, he told me that tennis will die with him. That is to say, that he will never retire. He will always be a tennis player, and tennis will die with him. That is a very strong phrase, but it paints in full body who Guillermo Vila is.
Muy fuerte, pero que pinta de cuerpo entero quién es Guillermo Vilas.
It's a funny thing, wanting to die playing tennis. I love tennis, but I just don't want to die.
What do you want to die?
I don't want to die. Okay. I'm all for eternity. Like I'm working on eternity, okay. But you never stop hearing from me, Dario. But yeah, I think it's a funny one. Thank you, Dario, for joining us on Who's Your Don Bradman Episode 2. This was the story of Guillermo Vilas.